For anyone who likes to write down the title of the sermon, the title of this sermon is Increasing Our Sense of Urgency. In that sermon back in April, the story about the night to be much observed was brought into the picture. And I always find that very inspiring, going back there and talking about that particular night and the spiritual lessons that are there for us. You know, it's an amazing thing when you go back in the Old Testament. There's so much back there that, that we're to build upon, the things that are meant for us spiritually, things about the temple, things about the various, even Leviticus 16. I'm always inspired by that, referring to the two goats and talking about atonement. There's so much there that God has given in those books that are for us. For us to learn from, things that have to do with a spiritual framework that God had, even those physical things that were done by the Israelites. And this is the case as well, the night to be much observed. And again, we talk about that on that particular time, having a sense of urgency, because it reminds us of the importance of a vital duty that each one of us has. And we have a duty, a responsibility, to be spiritually observant, to be spiritually alert. And so again, wanting to talk about that a little bit today. I thought it'd be good to go back to 1 Thessalonians to begin here today. First Thessalonians chapter 5. And by the way, I wasn't planning on this extra time for the sermon. I was going to have a small, shorter sermon since we had a potluck and everything. And but somehow I tend to use up the time when I'm given it. Anyway. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and beginning in verse 5. You've heard a little bit about that here in recent times, speaking of being the children of light. And going on in this, it says, "You are the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness." You know, we're not of the night. And but we live in a time when it is night throughout this world. And as it goes on to say in verse 6, it says, "Therefore, let us not sleep as do others." You know, I'm very sober just in the very beginning of this to think about and understand things having to do with being asleep, examples of being drowsy and falling asleep that Matthew 25 talks about when it talks the parable of the 10 virgins and mentions what even happened within the church and things that we have gone through within the church. And these are very dangerous times for God's people, because that's the natural tendency when you've been asleep, when you've been drowsy. You may be shaken out of that. You may be awakened out of that, which, in respect, has happened throughout the church in different places at different times. But the tendency is, when you've been in that state, is to go back to that state. It is a battle to fight. It's a battle that we're warned about over and over again, and certainly something that we're warned about there in Matthew 25. And so we're admonished again here. "Therefore, let us not sleep as do others." And so we see that in the world around us. The world can't help it. But I think of all people, we can. We should be able to, obviously, if we yield ourselves to God, if we're crying out to God, if we have a zealousness about God's way of life. There's nothing to become drowsy about, nothing to become to be in sleep about. But again, an admonition and warning here. "Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch," God says. We're to watch. We are to be alert. We are to be observant. And so it's an admonition here that not to take this state for granted, the fact that we have been called, the fact that our minds have been opened up, the fact that light has been given to us and that we are the children of light. Nothing to be taken for granted at all. We're admonished over and over again to watch, to be alert, and not let this particular state come upon us. It's something we have to battle. But let us watch. In the Greek, this word means to refrain from sleep. It's a word that's used like in the night watch. You know, they had a job, a sentry who had a post, a duty, a responsibility. When he was on guard, he was to be alert. He was to be watchful. Matter of fact, some pretty severe penalties for individuals who would fall asleep, who would become drowsy if they didn't do well at their post, at their particular job that was given to them. And the same thing is true for us, the spiritual lessons. We can't afford to become drowsy. We can't afford to become sleepy. And not only can it hurt us, it can hurt others as well. And so tremendous things to learn from, and examples like this, and just the meaning of the word and how it was used. So there were night watches, and individuals were posted there to keep guard, to be alert. And what were they to be on guard against? Well, you know, they were to be watchful. They were to have an attentive mind, eyes, ears, to be observant to everything that was going on around them, to any possible dangers that might come upon them. And that's the way we're supposed to be. And there's only one way to do that, and that's to be close to God, to be spiritually alert. And so, again, these examples that we can learn from here, again, this word basically used to mean to be alert, the duty of vigilance, as it's even brought out, it's a duty of vigilance, that's how the word is used, to be on careful guard, to be ready. And it says here, but let us watch and be sober. There's a lot said here with this. Watching, there's another ingredient, if you will, a need to be sober, to be sober-minded. An individual who is on guard, who has that particular duty, needs to be sober-minded to potential danger, to recognize what it will mean if he begins to drift off to sleep, what it means if he lets down on his job. And there's a soberness that all of us need to have as well, to recognize that there is a duty, a responsibility that God has given to us and monitors us to do, so that our minds are alert, so that we are attending to dangers around us, and there are things he's even given us to watch, to be careful of, especially at the end of an age. Verse 7. For they that sleep in the night. They sleep in the night. In many cases we see that people prefer not to see or even consider real dangers. There's an attitude there, even in society, where we don't like to think about those kinds of things. We talk about them to a degree, but when someone is asleep, they can't recognize that they're in that state. They don't recognize the state they're in. They have to be shaken out of it. And so it's a very dangerous state. When one is asleep, it's one of the worst conditions, especially spiritually, because the person doesn't know it. And literally, there's primarily one way that the person can be waken out of that, and it's if God does it. And goes on to say then, for they that sleep in the night, and they that are drunken in the night. And for the church, we can talk about a kind of spiritual stupor that we can get into, something that has to be fought against. We can become intoxicated as well by the pulls of this world around us and the ways of this world. So again, dangers on every side as far as our lives is concerned. Verse 8, but let us, who are of the day, we have those opportunities that God has given to us. Our minds have been opened up. We do have access to God the Father through Jesus Christ. And the blessing of the petition that separated us and has separated all mankind has been torn, has been taken away, and now gives us the ability to have to come before the very throne room of God, if you will, on a regular basis, whenever we desire, to pray to God, to have a relationship with God the Father. So again here, verse 8, but let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love. So again, being admonished here to be sober if we're of the day. And there's a responsibility there to go above and beyond then. There's a way to do this, to be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith. Again, I'm reminded of a sermon Mr. Buchanan gave talking about one faith, talking about what faith is, and a very meaningful, very meaty sermon and understanding what God has given to us, the oneness of mind that God desires that we have with Him, to be able to come into full agreement with Him about His way of life, His law, His purpose, His desires for us. And then it says, again, not just of faith, but of love, agape. This is a very inspiring word to understand what it means, to recognize this is not something that man has in his capacity. It's something that comes from God. The source is God Almighty. To have agape or agape, that love of God, that we have to have God's Spirit in order to even experience it. The world doesn't experience it. The world doesn't have it. The source is God Almighty. That's why I'm astounded sometimes when people I've talked to in times past, when we talk about brotherly love, and I think of Mr. Armstrong when he used to talk about an example of a mother's love for her child. It's a beautiful love. But he made the point, that's a human love. It's not God's love. And it still has, in the best of the man has, and he used that example because it's a beautiful kind of love. It still isn't God's love because it still has a measure of selfishness in it. And it's something that human beings can't help, because a mother doesn't have that same love for other children as she does for her own. There's a natural bonding and a binding that takes place there in life. But it's not God's kind of love, still. And so he used that example to help us to understand that there's something beyond that, there's something far greater than that, that helps us to be able to love others in a more powerful, more meaningful way. So again here, we're told, let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and of love, and recognizing that that comes from a relationship with God. Always has, always will, to treasure it. You know, I was very moved by going out to Western Kansas when I went out there a couple weeks ago to perform a funeral. And something that struck me in a very powerful way, I thought, I'm thinking about the church, how it's so scattered right now, and how that there are so few in different areas who are remaining, and I'm thinking about that particular area of the country, because it never really had a lot of people in the church anyway, being kind of sparsely populated out there in western Kansas where I grew up, and how far apart people live from each other. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, the time, the money, the effort was being spent in doing this. And I thought, I was humbled by it, because I thought, this, think of the individuals. There are going to be some people out there for the first time in their life who are going to hear something that they have never heard. They're going to hear something about a plan of God, about resurrection. Not people going off to heaven or hell, but understanding that there is truth out here and a plan and purpose that God has. And to be able to say that, I think sometimes we have been around the church for so long that it's easy to begin to take for granted some of the things we have. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, this is a treasure. Do we really grasp the depth of the treasure that God has given to us? Do we really see it as a treasure that we're, if you look on this earth, we're not very many people. Never have been, even when we had large numbers. When we talk about large numbers, 150,000 on this earth, counting children. Well, not a lot of people in the scheme of things. And certainly a whole lot fewer now. Do we understand, do we grasp, do we think about those things, what God has given to us, how precious they are? When you read about the pearl of great price, you know, we read those things, we hear about those things, but does it really get in here? Does it really sink in deep that we treasure what God has given, because we know the vast majority of the world has never even heard of those things that we could even begin to take for granted because we've been so blessed, so wealthy in a sense, spiritually. God has given us so much. So I thought about that. I thought, you know, it's an incredible honor to know what we know. What an incredible blessing to have what we have. What an incredible thing to be able to share it with one person. If that's God's purpose, that they hear something one time and it does something in their minds. You know, God talks about there's a time that in a day of visitation there are going to be people who are going to glorify God because it's going to come back to them. Things that they've come in contact with, different ones of God's people, things that they've heard. I think about things that people are getting ready to go through in this world. That there's going to come a time because of things that they have read a long time ago in the Plain Truth magazine or heard in a telecast or a broadcast. There are things that are planted in many people's minds around this earth. Every once in a while you come in contact with one who has nothing to do with the church, but when they find out about you, there's still something in their mind and they ask some questions about certain things that they heard a long, long time ago. You think about the impact that's going to have on certain people's minds when things come to the point they do in this earth. And a hope that individuals are going to have because they heard something that was true. And it's there. I reminded the disciples when Jesus Christ was working with them. They didn't have God's Spirit yet. They were being drawn by God's Spirit. They were being worked with by God's Spirit. But they didn't have God's Spirit like they did when the church began in Acts in the day of Pentecost in a very powerful way. And as you read some of those things in their lives, those things would come back, flooding back in their minds, and all of a sudden they would understand what Jesus Christ was saying to them. Because as you read through a lot of the things, especially in the book of John, they didn't understand what he was saying so often. They took it physically. He would tell them about something, and they would take it physically. I think of the example at one time when there were many disciples, it talks about not just the 12, but talking about those who were following him and listening to him, and he started talking about their need to partake of his body, his flesh, and his blood. And there were some who were so offended by that because they didn't understand what he was saying. They took it physically. That they left him and said many at that point in time quit following him, quit listening to him. Because they were offended at what they heard. Because that was a hideous thing for a Jewish person to hear about eating human flesh and drinking blood, human blood to boot. Because they didn't get it. And so much of John is about those kinds of things where they still don't, even the disciples still didn't understand many of the things that Jesus Christ was saying. I think, what an incredible thing we do, what and what we have. But we still tend to think many times on a physical plane, and we have to cry out to God to help us to understand these things. And so again, here talking about faith and love and foreign helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not appointed us to wrath. God has appointed us to salvation. He hasn't appointed us to wrath. Wrath, generally as you read it here, has to do with the payment for sin, the penalty for sin. And punishment in this world for disobedience. God hasn't appointed us to that. He's appointed us to something totally different. He's given us a calling, his first fruits. But God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ. In that sermon last April, we focused on the importance again of the lesson to be received from the night to be much observed. We live in the night, but we're not to be of the night. We're to be of the day. God's given us that ability. The word observed again means watch, even back there in the Old Testament. It means watch. It means vigilant. Same way we use it in the New Testament. When God tells us that we're to watch, that we're to be alert spiritually. I think that's why it'd be good for us again to go back and revisit some of these things and thinking about some of that and recognizing that this is a spiritual mindset that needs to be nurtured, the sense of urgency, the sense of being watchful and being alert. And so again, the need to go back and think about these things in the sense of increasing our sense of urgency. We're living in some incredibly sobering times in the church, and we need to see it as that. As God's people, we need to grasp just how sobering these times really are. As part of being sobered and learning to be more watchful, more vigilant, as we just read about here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 6, where it says, but let us watch. It's not just watch, but also to be sober. Let us watch and be sober. Because just like in the Old Testament there, for the night to be much observed, this is exactly what they were to do. They were to be sobered in what they were doing and what they were to be, what the task was before them. And an incredible thing of finally coming to a point of leaving Egypt, there are things that we're to do in this all of our life once we're called. To be watchful, to be sober, and the journey we're on. And so again, I think it'd be good at this time for us to take a more sobering look at things that are happening in this world and the things that are happening in the environs of the church, because those things should sober us, especially when we think about the time and where we are in the scheme of things. I'm going to read to you from the first paragraph of the most recent issue of the Newswatch, which is a newsletter that we publish under the heading of Europe on the Rise, because there's some things here to drive my point home here and what I'm talking to you about, because I think about the reaction of different ones that hear about some of these things I'm going to talk to you about. The reaction of some concerning the latest news of Europe by those that remain in the Church of God, I mentioned here, will likely be a ho-hum yawn. But things that are coming out of Europe and people hearing these things, we hear it, but what does it mean? What kind of an impact does it have upon us? Or does it have an impact upon us? I went on to mention there, at first, it may even be received as somewhat interesting, when instead it should be striking a measure of fear in our hearts and minds. There is a measure of fear. As we look at various things that are happening in this world, to recognize time and how short time can be in our life, and recognizing things we have known for a long, long time are now there at the doorstep. It's an incredibly sobering thing what's happening in Europe today. And yet sometimes we've heard it for so long, it doesn't shock us. It doesn't have the impact on our lives that it should. It's like TV today. If someone were to be resurrected of just 10, 20 years ago, and they were to sit down in front of TV here in the United States today, you think they would be shocked by what they saw? You think they'd be sobered by seeing an incredible change? I've seen a change in 1 year that's sobering, of how they're trying to push the limits out here and what they're teaching and what they're telling people. You know, it's a sick, sick world we live in. But see, if we just receive a little bit at a time, sometimes that shock isn't there. It's like when the world was shocked at one time when they saw Elvis shaking his hips. Or when the Beatles came along and things they saw then. But those things today are so mild compared to back then. And the same thing is true in the sense of an analogy here of things that we have heard for so long that after a while, if we're not careful, we can become dull of hearing. Our senses aren't what they need to be sometimes. And so that has to do with some of the things we're talking about here in the sense of what I'm going to be reading here in a moment out of the Newswatch concerning certain news items coming out of Europe. I asked some of the people up around Toledo if they'd heard some of the things we did when we were over in Europe. We had the opportunity of being over there recently, Laura and I did. And at the time we were over there, they started talking about a need for a common military in Europe. We've heard these things for so long that sometimes when things finally come together, they don't hit us like they should. They don't jar us like they should. When in reality, there is a measure of fear that if we really thought about it and really were shocked in the sense of what's taking place over there, would send chills up and down your spine. But sometimes we don't have those kinds of reactions anymore. I want to read this out of the Newswatch. Mentioned here, do we grasp the significance of the kinds of reports that have been coming out of Europe about plans for their own United Rapid Deployment Army? Out of Brussels today, that's December 16th, came a report on comments being made by General Wesley Clark, NATO's most senior military commander in Europe. He criticized those who have suggested that Europe may be able to develop its autonomous military capability away from NATO structures. The general attended yesterday's meeting of NATO foreign ministers, which debated Europe's plans to set up a rapid reaction force of 40 to 60,000 troops by 2003. People hear this and they think, 40 to 60,000 troops, that doesn't mean anything. There's nothing to be excited about. There's nothing to be sobered about in all this. Oh, yes, there is. But it doesn't hit us. An initiative launched at the weekend, which has provoked tension with the United States. Going on, it says, let's notice a few other quick quotes that should jump out at us. An article titled, "The EU Turns Its Attention from Plowshares to Swords." This is in The Economist magazine of November 26th, had the following quotes. And the Germans laid out a timetable. The EU, they suggested, should give itself a defense identity by 2003, if not sooner. Many French politicians and businessmen, however, want to create not just a defense identity for the European Union, but also a common front against the English-speaking world. I tell you what, it's a sobering thing when you see the sentiment and the attitudes that are growing in Europe toward Americans and toward the English as well. But right now they're trying to work with the British still, to a point. It is in that context that they and quite a few Germans see such events as the recent merging of the defense manufacturing giants between France and Germany. You know what's an incredible thing? To see newspapers over there, to see headlines, things being written, comparing what they're doing over there with Charlemagne. The time of Charlemagne. This is a common thing in Europe. Now, this doesn't move us because we don't hear those things over here, and most people wouldn't have a perspective of what that means anyway, but there is a sense of a unity that they have over there now that they're growing in when you see things in the news or you see certain news articles. That is a very sobering thing because of what we understand and because of what we know. And to make comparisons like that, and if you know some of the things about history and Charlemagne and know who was behind it at that time, Frankish king, it's France. France is pushing this more than anyone else over there. They're even pushing Germany. It's an incredible thing that's taking place. Because Germany's still holding back. But France is the one pushing them. From another report out of Europe, Germany's Rudolf Scharping gave a December 2000 deadline for the establishment of a rapid response infrastructure that will end dependence on the United States. Went on to say that perhaps it may be several years before a powerful force could rise out of Europe, but don't be deceived to think it cannot happen quickly if it's in God's timing to allow it. The structure is being well laid out. It's only a matter of time before it will one day burst on the scene with life of its own. And that's what we need to understand. Because when it bursts on the scene, brethren, it happens quickly. The structure is there, and all they have to do is use it. That's what's important about all these things. It's the structure. Even though it might be a 40 to 60,000 rapid force deployment, the reality is the French have a military. The Germans have a military of their own. But if they have a common bond among themselves and a structure among themselves, it doesn't take much to make it much larger and much more quickly if that's what they want to do, if there's a purpose for it. And I'll tell you something else that became very clear over there as well. An attitude of mind by different leaders, especially Prodi and some of the others over there. Nothing's going to stop them from coming together now. Anything that interferes, anything that interferes with their economic desires as far as the new euro and some of the things taking place there, the attitude is nothing's going to stop them. Nothing had better get in their way. That's why it's good to listen. I'll get to that in a moment here. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Going on and still other developments. We're reminded of another matter that we have always been assured of for over 40 years now. Great Britain will not be a part of the final beast power because Joseph is going to suffer under that power. And so from the Times, London, December 14th, is an article titled, Make Up Your Mind on the Euro. Romano Prodi, yesterday, challenged Britain to make up its mind on the euro and its future role in Europe or pay the price of exclusion. He used his first interview with a British newspaper since becoming the European Commission president to warn Britain that it would have to make tough decisions if it wanted to become an enthusiastic partner in the great mission to unify Europe. But the penalties of going it alone would be greater, he warned. He went on to say, You sometimes have to do things understanding that there are moments in history so important that if you're not in, your country will suffer in the long run. Those words, just reading them right now, I'll be candid with you, send some chills up my spine. Because they're prophetic. Because they will not be a part of it. And they are going to suffer in the long run, you say. As we come to a close on this issue, please stop to honestly consider the response most people that you personally know throughout the scattered church. Do you believe they show shock and apprehension over such news that comes flooding out of Europe? Probably not. Do you? How dull and complacent are we? This is much of the reason of our continued struggle with scattering, lethargy, and complacency. So it's a sobering thing. That's the whole point of this. These things should be sobering to us, things that are happening over there, because there is a structure. There are things that are coming together in a very powerful way, and that's all they have to have is a structure. You know, we have known these things for too long, perhaps. And therefore, because of that, we can become dull of hearing, unable to be shocked or sobered by the reality of what is now in front of us. Do you know how long the church has been warning about these things that are now happening in Europe? You know how long we have believed these things? I find these inspiring and sobering at the same time. You know, we have known that Europe would become united with a political union, an economic union, a military union, to be added to an already existent religious union that they have in Europe, which again is very evident. There is one church that people look to. Those who do look to a church primarily through I'm not talking about Britain and these things. I'm talking about the continent. And I think sometimes maybe by having knowledge for so long, we can and do become complacent sometimes in these things. We can become too familiar, or so familiar with the knowledge that we're not readily shocked by some of these kinds of things that happen. I want to go back and read some things to you because I think this is sobering, because it should increase our sense of urgency. Back in the Plain Truth in December 1956, I want to read to you from an article titled, Foretold 22 Years Ago, and this was back in 1956. From behind the Iron Curtain, world-shaking headlines are flashing. How long, brethren, have we heard? How long have we been watching? How long have we been told about these things? If we're not careful, we can take it like a cry, woof, woof. And after a while, become dull because it's always been there. We've always been doing it. But see, that's our responsibility. We don't know when, but these things should sober us. Because we do have understanding of what's going to happen in this world. They're not pleasant things. But because we see those kinds of things, no matter when people lived, during Philadelphia as an example, in the 40s and the 50s, there were things, if you go back and read, I went through and I read a lot of things in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s that have been published in the church as I was thinking about some of these things. And on a continuing basis as a whole, for so long, up into the 70s and early 80s, there were articles. Every once in a while, things would happen in Europe. And our attention would be focused over there to think about the potential of time. Are we watchful? Are we being alert? Because you see, there's a need for that. You know what that does by watching things just like in world events? It can sober you to the reality of the time we live, no matter when that time is. And because that soberness then has a response in our minds of a relationship with God, because we know how much we need God. And so it can be a very healthy thing for you spiritually, you see, for each and every one of us, to be sober-minded, to be watchful of things that are taking place, even though we don't know the exact time. But the danger in all this is, if we've heard it for a long time, it begins to, that sense of urgency and that sense of being sobered, we can begin to lose some of that. And there's a tremendous danger in that because we have heard for so long. And so I can't help that when I read this and think what's being said, because even then there was a sense of urgency, a sense of watching, which they had a duty to do, just like we do now. It's not lessened now. It's only heightened because we're closer to it now than back in 1956 and 1957, whereas this article talks about, we're told, 22 years ago. I find these things inspiring because we have known as a church. God has given us knowledge and insight of those things that are true. We know. The world doesn't know. The world doesn't understand. So again here, from behind the Iron Curtain, world-shaking headlines are flashing. Communist oppression in Eastern Europe is being overthrown. Do you remember, maybe you don't remember the times of 1956. Do you remember the times in the early 50s when there were drills even in schools and getting under chairs, fallout shelters, you knew where to go, advertisements? See, a lot of us, we don't remember those things. I was a young person back then. I don't even remember it very well at all. Some of you remember it much better. But see, there were things happening in Russia. There was a fear because of the power that man now had at his fingertips to start a nuclear war. You know, the kinds of bombs that man had never even dreamed of. And so there was a fear in people. There was fear of people in the United States. And I'll tell you what, there was a fear in Europe too. Because you see, Russia is pretty close by. Where are they going to be in all this? And so they had concerns that molded and fashioned their thinking in Europe back in the 50s. But it didn't come together. But the framework was in part there in their hearts and minds and some individuals, but this wasn't a reality in any fashion or form. So that's why this is being brought up. Communist oppression in Eastern Europe is being overthrown. The way is being prepared for a colossal third force in world politics, a European Federation of Nations more powerful than either Russia or the United States. You think, 1956, isn't that amazing? It had to be kind of a joke in a sense. A lot of people would hear that back then. It's not as much of a joke today because there are people who recognize, as far as the economy is concerned, of the potential of Europe being united, much greater than that of the United States. But what we have been warning you about is happening precisely as we have stated, and as much as 22 years in advance. That's how you can know that our work is not of men, but of God. Even back then in 1956, because of what they knew, they said, you can know that this isn't from men. Why? Because there are things happening. How could anyone know those things were going to happen even 22 years ago before World War II, or especially during World War II? But we'll get into some of that in a moment here. And if you think about it now, that was over 65 years ago from now. Going on in the article, it says, as far back as August 1950, we said, but before Russia is ready, the world will be stunned to see Germany emerge suddenly in a power never equaled by Hitler, by a union of 10 nations in Europe, probably including some of the present puppets of Russia. Isn't that amazing what happened later on? And later on we started thinking about the two legs and the east and west and five toes. You know, that didn't come too much later. This is going far back to 1950. It wasn't something new. Again, probably including some of the present puppets of Russia in a gigantic United States of Europe. This definitely is prophesied. And farther on the article, it says that in August 1934, over 22 years ago, Mr. Armstrong wrote of the Roman Empire, a United States of Europe, or federation of 10 European nations within the bounds of the old Roman Empire. You see, we've heard those things for so long that maybe they don't shock us and maybe don't startle us in the same degree. Then a few months later in the Plain Truth, in the April 57th issue, is an article about the prophesied beast. There are some more interesting statements made here. All of our older readers know that this work has been warning our people for over 20 years of the certainty of this coming European Union and its fearful portent for the British and American people. And now, it's almost upon us. See, how many times have we heard warnings, and how does that affect our mind and our thinking? But see, it was good for them back then because that stirred. If you're sobered by the reality of the potential of what can happen, because you're doing your duty to be observant, you're doing your duty to watch, and you're seeing things that are happening, and you're saying, could it be now? Because you see, we could look at what's happening now and say, could it be now? We better be doing that, and it could be much farther up the road.
But again, there's always that in the back of our mind. How fast can it come together? We don't know.
The article went on to talk about a special meeting in Britain for the very purpose of discussing the very need for a combined Europe. This meeting that, as it goes on to say in the article, pledged to help create this European Union was addressed, first of all, by a member of the British Parliament, Sir Victor Raikes. He began his speech by stating that he was proud to be associated with this movement to form a third force in the world. That's what they called it then. Then he launched an attack on American politics and asserted that the European powers must now integrate in order to have sufficient strength to go it alone.
Because, see, in the mid-50s, it was still that threat over there, next door. It's kind of interesting to note what's going on now, because those things move Europeans.
The article went on to talk about what the principal speaker had to say at that meeting, Mr. Kenneth de Courcy, who was described as being on the extreme right in British political circles. The plain truth referred to this statement by saying, after more general attacks on American policy, he said, I would hate to see the United States as the main Western power in another war. Then he got into the heart of his message, a plea for Britain to join in a united Europe, a third power bloc able to oppose either Russia or the United States if need be. He described the political, economic, and military advantage such a united Europe would have and said he favored a common European citizenship for everyone. Much farther into the article is this interesting paragraph. Yes, the paralyzing fear of Russia, dramatized by the recent bloodbath in Hungary, is now bringing about what might have seemed impossible only a few years ago. The European nations are at last going to forget their ancient rivalries and get together. By this, they hope to build a third power bloc, even stronger than Russia and the United States. So when you see things happening in Chechnya, and threats that are going on, and who's in power, is the military power, is Yeltsin in power, I'll tell you, there's some scary things coming out of Russia again. But see, there's a reason for all that. There's a purpose behind all that. And there is a way that that affects the minds of people in France, in Germany, and some of those other countries, and their desire to have something in order to counteract that, because we're way over here, and they know how we think. And some other things happened recently in another war in that part of the world that's kind of sparked some of this desire now to have their own rapid deployment force. They see a need. Things are going to happen in God's time frame. God brings these things about. Nations that rise and nations that fall. Because they're going to be things that take place exactly according to the way he desires them to take place. I'll think of some scriptures over here. Toward the end of that article, we might turn over there in Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. These things are not for the purpose of scare. These things are for the purpose to be sobered. And there is a measure of fear that's healthy for us as well as people, because there are fearful things coming upon mankind, and we hurt. We should hurt inside. We do, as we think about some of those things and what it's going to mean eventually. But what's really sobering is to recognize, again, all those things for all those years, they're now on our doorstep. They're knocking at the door. It's there. It's there. Things we talked about for so long that could possibly come together, that framework is all together now in that respect, except for the military part, which is rapidly going to be coming together here amongst themselves. And all someone has to do is step into that. The framework is there. Revelation 17, I want to read these first because this article talks about these even back there in 1957. Revelation 17 and verse 10, notice, and there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is. You know what's incredible when you start reading this? Notice how it's written. When could there be a time? When was there a time that this was true? Does that have an impact on your mind and show who we are as a people? And show how God worked and what he was doing many, many years ago and through whom he worked? It's an incredible thing, brother. There are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is yet to come. There's only one time that this fits. Only one time
that it could ever apply. And it was when Mr. Armstrong understood it. It was at the time it was revealed to him. If my understanding is correct about the story, it was during World War II, when they began to see what was going to happen in Europe, and that Germany was not going to be the power at that time, because they were watching what was happening in Europe at that time. Could this be fulfilling prophecy? But it became evident that they weren't going to come through at this time. And things began to happen. He began to understand something. And this here. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen. And one is. Only happened. Only was true at the time it was revealed. At the time that understanding was given of what this applied to. And who it was given to. When he understood that there is one right now. And he was given understanding there's one to follow. There's going to be another revival of the Holy Roman Empire. Those are incredible things to understand, brother. To understand who we are. To understand how God worked through Mr. Armstrong. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was, thankfully, when he comes, a short time, a short space. Thank God. Thank God it's going to happen swiftly on this earth and not be a long, drawn-out thing for 10, 15, 20, 100 years, but a quick thing that happens, swift. That's God's mercy, even though it's so incredible what takes place. Thankfully, it's still as swift as it is. Verse 11, and the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, then is of the seven, and goes into perdition. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. That's sobering in itself, because it shows how quick it is. It shows how fast everything happens when it does start happening. Verse 13, these have one mind. It's not the exact nations in the common market right now, or not common market, I'm going back many years, the EU, the European Union, say, but there are going to be nations coming out of there. They have one mind and shall give their power and strength to the beast. They agree to do that. They have one mind to do that. When it happens quickly, they experience this power together for a quick time, and they agree to give it to one source quickly and powerfully. But they have to have a framework for it, something we've understood. It was being taught in the church, being told this world back in 1934 about 10 nations that were going to rise out of Europe. Those things are sobering. Those things should move us. They should give us the strength of confidence and understanding what God has been doing with us for so long, and yet a soberness too, and an understanding of a need to continue to watch, to be alert, to recognize that those things that were there for so long, now they are in front of us. They are together. Notice what was written back in 1957 concerning these verses. It says, in verses 11 and 12, we see that one more head is to rise up. One more revival of this system is to take place. Notice that the ten horns picture in pledging their allegiance and support to the final great military political leader called the beast. And so we need to be moved with an increased sense of urgency to recognize the times we live in. These are dangerous times for God's people. And we can talk about some of these things that are at our doorstep, the framework that's there, and sometimes thinking about these things, even the chills that can go up and down your spine because of it, and understanding who we are and the times we live in. If we are alert, vigilant, watchful events in this world that are pointing more and more to a final fulfillment, then we should even be more deeply sobered, brethren. Move more, if you will, to an increased sense of urgency concerning our calling and our relationship with God. We need to be more zealous about preparing ourselves for the kingdom of God in the world tomorrow, because there are things here that apply to the church as well that should be very sobering to us. There are things we recognize that are happening in Europe, but what about the church? These things we're going to go into now, because it's twofold things we're to watch. We're to watch things that have happened in the world, but we were also admonished over and over again to watch for things within the church, to be alert to things that are going to happen within the church. Let's turn over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. An even greater witness of where we are in time is what we've been experiencing within the church. These are events that should ring in our ears. A sense of urgency that we
must have if we're to be successful in fighting the battles that yet remain in front of us? Because we have battles, we've had ongoing battles, and there are more battles ahead of us. It's the way our life is. I think about some of these things, even though we become... Now, when I talk about we, I'm talking about the scattered church, wherever we are, wherever God's people have been, and talking about the effects of things happening out of Europe. I feel that, obviously that amongst ourselves, that there's a group here that is moved by those things when they hear those things coming out of Europe. But when I talk about we as a scattered church and things we've gone through, so much of the church isn't going to be moved by those things. They're not going to be sobered by those things that are happening. And neither by the things that were talked about back in Matthew 24 and what Paul had to say in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 here, because it's very pointed what they had to say. Very pointed what Jesus Christ had to say, and it's very pointed here what Paul had to say here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ." So if we grasp the setting here and what he's talking here about the return of Jesus Christ, about Jesus Christ's coming and his return to this earth and receiving that kingdom. And so this is the subject matter of what Paul is addressing here. So he says, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit, nor by word, nor by letter as from us, as that day of Christ is at hand." So he's saying, in essence here, to paraphrase some things, we understand that Jesus Christ is to return, but don't be, in essence here, as he talks about, troubled, shaken in mind, that this is right happening right now. He says, because, in essence, that day of Christ is not at hand right now, because there are certain things that have to take place first. There are certain things that have to take place within the church, and this is what he's getting ready to tell them. So he says, don't be shaken in mind as by a letter or something else that day now is upon us, because, in essence, they were being braced that there is more time. There was a time when Paul had a sense of urgency, a greater sense of urgency, that time could be sooner. And then later on, God began to help them to understand, show to them that there was more time. And so this is a part of what he's telling the church. And so he says in verse 3, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come." So in other words, yes, we should be watchful and alert in our own lives, but there are certain things here that for right now, no, not right now. "For that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first." And that hadn't been experienced yet within the church. And they knew that. So they knew that certain things had to take place. And so Paul was warning them that an apostasy, that's what this word falling away means, an apostasy had to take place within the church. That's kind of foreign to our minds to think that something like that could happen in a great way within the church to them at that time. And there was a time going many years back that we knew of certain things that were going to happen in the church, but we never even began to grasp the magnitude of what these verses here meant, of what an apostasy and what a falling away means. We used to talk about the potential of 50-50, half Philadelphia and half Laodicean, and we used to think about the parable of the 10 virgins, maybe 50-50, the 5 virgins here and the 5 virgins there, the 5 foolish and the 5 wise. We've even learned things about that we didn't grasp at that time. But see, there are things that God reveals to us and brings us along and helps us to grasp and understand as time goes along. And some things, if we knew everything that was going to happen and the way it happens, we might be so discouraged that we wouldn't even care to continue forward. It'd be so disheartening to us. "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first." To abandon, to leave the truth. That's what an apostasy has to do with. And that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. This is the only time in nearly 2,000 years, if you look at time for the church, that this has happened, in essence, from the top down in the structure that we had within the church. And there was a time during the time of John, which I think was being mentioned in the last tape here. You were talking about some of the things about John, talking about the work of God, what the work of God is. And think about that particular time, things that began to happen to the church later on that didn't happen, they didn't experience before that. And they began to experience different things where people began to leave the church and different apostasy. But that's within the church. It wasn't from the primary structure of the church. It wasn't from the ministry and from the leadership and those who were to lead and guide and direct God's people and to be faithfully administering what God had given to us as a people. This is a unique time. We've been living through it. A time of apostasy. And it's not over with because it's still going on. Let's turn back to Matthew 24. Paul was giving the Thessalonians there in 2 Thessalonians a framework. And he said certain events must take place. Don't think that day is now, right now.
until these things have to happen first. These things have to be fulfilled first. Little did we know, it's still going to be nearly 2,000 years later from that point in time, or little would they have known at that time even. Notice Matthew 24 and verse 12. Things that Jesus Christ had to say. It says, "And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold." You know, that began to happen. I think of the 70s when some of those things began to happen within the church, because they started creeping in back then, at that time. This is about the church. This is not about the world. This verse cannot apply to the world. You know why? Because the word love is agape. It's God's love. The world doesn't have that love working in them. That love cannot wax cold in the world because they don't have it. They have never been called to it. They've never been called to experience it. There's only one people that's ever been called to experience that, that has the potential for that experience and their ability to have that living within them, and that's within the church of God. That's within those who are called by God, who have their minds open, who receive the Spirit of God, because it comes through the Spirit of God, because that love is God's love, agape. "And because iniquity shall abound," abound where? Well, it's going to be in the world, yes. It's like I mentioned about TV and some of the sick things that are being taught to people as a normal way of life today that's not normal at all, and pushing the limits and everything that they can, it seems. But it's in the church as well, sin, that begins to creep in. "And because iniquity shall abound," obviously, what happens when sin enters in? We're cut off from God's Spirit. It begins to wax cold. And the more and more yield to sin and are cut off from God's Spirit, maybe impregnated with God's Spirit, but we can cut ourselves off from a continual supply of God's Spirit. It's always been that way. And we need that. It's like an umbilical cord. We're the church of God, Mr. Armstrong used to say, an embryo, a beautiful picture, an embryo. And we need that life blood, just like a baby does in the womb. And we as a people that are growing need that life supply of God's Spirit feeding us on a daily basis, filling our lives. But it can be cut off. And when that supply is cut off, we may know the truth. We may have knowledge of the truth. And there are things we have learned, incredible knowledge. But what brings that knowledge to life is the Spirit of God. Those words are life when they're mixed with God's Spirit. It's what Jesus Christ was talking about when we talk about these words. You know, they were life, and there was life in it because of God's Spirit. That's what brings it alive in our minds when we hear it. And so the same thing is true with God's love. The ability to experience things of God, the nature of God, things about God, God's own love, and to have that live in us, in our relationships with one another, and to treat one another the way God says to, like 1 Corinthians talks about. That's all about that kind of love, agape, God's love, and the way God's love is. That's why I love those verses back there in 1 Corinthians 13, because when you start going into it, and it talks about God's love, agape, it says, what good is all this knowledge? If we had all of understanding, not just the knowledge that God has given to us at the end and restored to the church, but what if we did understand every event that was going to happen in prophecy? And what if the ministry held on to those things and didn't have love? What good would that mean? You know, we're experiencing that as a church. People who want to hold fast to some things that are true and right. But if we don't treat one another properly, if God's love is not living in us and our relationships with one another, if we're controlling and manipulative in things we do, where's God? And what value is that knowledge? It has no value then, of and by itself, that kind of knowledge. It only does when God's Spirit's in it. And brings it alive and makes it work. Because God's word and God's way of life and God's law is all about relationships. And it's a vision and understanding we need to have deeply as a people. It's about a family that God desires to have. And so He's teaching us these things, and we're learning things that we should do and things that we shouldn't do, things that we should avoid. So again here, we've been living through this time, which obviously has accelerated and gotten worse as time went on, but these things began to creep into the church. I think of the 70s. I think of the shock I had when I came from Brickett Wood back in 1974 when the college closed down. Went to Big Sandy. And I saw things that shocked me as a young man. Things that were happening in the church in the United States that it was different from 2 years before. They began to creep into the environments of the college, and got so bad at times the college had to be closed down because of iniquity. That's why some of those things happened. It wasn't all financial. There were times because of iniquity. Okay? And so those things, we've lived through those things. It says the love of many will wax cold. You can't help it. And the more iniquity there is, the less of God's love there's going to exist and be there and be able to be experienced among ourselves. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. Endure to the end. Fight to the end. I think of right now, I think of all times where so many are giving up and just quitting. This is the time to hold on more than ever before. This is the time to dig in more than ever before because it's so much closer. But because of what we've experienced, sometimes people become so disillusioned. Maybe sometimes, obviously, because we put our faith in the wrong place. Put our trust in places that they shouldn't be, as you've been hearing about, in an unbalanced way, in a way that has to do with spiritual idolatry. And after those things are shattered, rather than learning the lesson that should be there, people become so disheartened. We live in disheartening times in some respects that we can just quit. This isn't the time to quit. This is the time to fight. That's what I see more and more of, people who are fighters. It's good to see fighters. We've been called to a fight. To fight for this way of life. God wants to know how much you want it. How much are you willing, how dear is it to you? How precious is it to you? You know, how much are you willing to fight for what God has given to you and placed before you? We have to fight for it. He that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. And then shall the end come. Of all people on the face of this earth, we have no excuse to not understand what this means. You've been hearing about it. Listen to two tapes talking about what the work is. We didn't talk about these things. Some of the things we wrote down on the news watch here, talked about that last night a little bit. Hadn't been talking to each other about these things, and he mentioned some things he was going to go into in a sermon, talking about the work a couple of weeks ago, and said, that's interesting. Been writing some of that same things in the news watch. You know? How does that happen? So often, I'm so moved when I hear sermonettes and sermons that work together, and you think, why do those things happen? It's not because of men. It's because of God's Spirit. If we'll humble ourselves and yield ourselves to God, God uses us as a people, all of us, in a work. In a work. It's still going on. We have to understand what that is, don't we? Notice verse 15, though. Something the church yet has to learn about in many ways. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Again, I want to read something from the News Watch because this is part of the subject here, and I want to do this because I've put it in words more succinct in that respect. So I want to read from this last News Watch here about some of this, about some of these things I'm talking about here today, having to do with the church. Some ministers and brethren believe and even teach that the church must grow large again so that the commission of the gospel being preached in all the world can be fulfilled. You know the people who believe that? That the church must become very large again because the gospel hasn't been preached into all the world. Therefore, the church must, of necessity, become very large again so that it can do that and greater because that has not been fulfilled. And so the church must become great again. There are people who, well, I think I said a church as well, but people who don't even believe there's been a great falling away yet. And if that belief is there, you know what that means? It means the church must become very large, much bigger than 150,000 men, women, and children. It must become much larger than that in order to have a greater falling away than what we have already experienced. There are many ministers who believe these things. Going on, does such a belief and teaching actually deny God? In other words, can that actually deny God? Believing that a great commission has not been fulfilled and has yet to be fulfilled, people have to be careful out here, I'll tell you. Why is it so difficult for people to acknowledge that the commission to do this has already been done through Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong? The bottom line is that either it has or it has not been fulfilled. What do you believe and why? People need to be cautious as to what they deny and what they reject as being true. Some will find that they have indeed denied and rejected what God has done, not what any man has done. What is the focus? Is it on man or is it on God? By denying what God did to the church and Mr. Armstrong up until the mid-1980s, we can be guilty of denying the work of God. There are many ministers who believe that they must teach about a work of God yet to be accomplished through their efforts and that of their organization. Brethren need to understand what they actually mean when they say such things. What is the truth? Did God not do a great work, growing continually greater until the year of Mr. Armstrong's death? Has that work continued to grow since that time? What is the evidence We talk about a witness. What is the witness? What is the testimony that's true? We should be able to look at it and say, I know what is true and what the true witness is because I see the evidence. That's what a witness has to do with, a testimony. It has to do with evidence. And we have a difficult time sometimes being true to ourselves because we have different ideas sometimes in our minds. What is the true witness and testimony? Some have based this false belief that the gospel has yet to be preached into all the world on a lack of understanding about the scripture. And the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. There are those who say this gospel could not have been preached into all the world because the end has not yet come. Are we so blind? I'm talking about the church. I'm not talking to you directly here. I'm talking about the church because Mr. Buchanan talked about the end in the last sermon. We're in the end, he said. We're paraphrasing that. The conclusion drawn is that if the end has not yet come, then someone else other than Mr. Armstrong must have that commission or that someone else must finish what has not yet been accomplished. You know, it's a dangerous thing not to receive and accept what God has done. What is the end? Is the end a specific final point? Is it when Jesus Christ returns? Is it the time of the day of the Lord? Is it when the time of great physical tribulation begins on this earth? Is it at the end of the millennium? Is it the end of the great white throne judgment? What is that end? Is it the time when many end time events are to occur, which have been prophesied to occur at the end, just before the return of Jesus Christ? Are we blinded to what has been happening and continues to happen within the church? Can we not grasp the most basic reality of where we find ourselves now? The end has come upon us. We are living in it. Are we too blind or asleep that we cannot see the obvious? The time of the Laodicean church is at the end. There is not another era to follow it. This is the last one. There are many prophesied events that are to take place during this end time. We read about them when it talks about things to happen at the end. Have those things been happening? Has 2 Thessalonians been happening? When Paul told them, don't be soon shaken, don't be troubled in mind that that day is at hand now. Because, in essence, this is what must first happen. There must first be a great falling away, an apostasy within the church. That's what it's talking about. We have been living through that time because that is an end time event, a very powerful event. It's like a barometer, if you will. It's like a timeline, if you will, as well, that Jesus Christ is returning. We also need to be careful how we use the term God's work. God has worked to accomplish His purpose over the millennia. Its specific focus is varied according to what needed to be accomplished at any specific period of time. For nearly 2,000 years, His work has been primarily about the church, about those He has called to be first in His family. That is the first focus, in essence. Pentecost, accomplishing that part of His plan for 2,000 years. We are the work of God. The gospel going into all the world was to take place toward the end of this 2,000 years. It was to be a specific and a unique work toward the end. Notice again what Mr. Armstrong had to say about the work and that commission in his letter to the church dated November 22, 1982. He said, no one had proclaimed that gospel to the world for nearly 1,900 years. I began proclaiming it then, but only to a small area in and around Lane County, Oregon, referring to the first plain truth in February 1934. Within 19 years, he said, I proclaimed it by radio and the plain truth over the entire United States. Then, the first week of 1953, precisely 1900 years, a century of time cycles of 19 years each, I began sending out this gospel to all of Europe over the world's most powerful radio station, Radio Luxembourg. Incredible things have happened in our past, in the church. Going on, is that phase of the work over? Is anyone coming close to accomplishing what was being done through Mr. Armstrong in preaching the gospel to this world? The truth is that no one is. No one's even coming close. The fact is the gospel has been preached into all the world as a witness to the exact extent that God intended it to be. After that was accomplished, the end did come upon us. Notice these verses again. Verse again when it says, when he talked about, verse 14, when it talks about the commission, or the, in essence we refer to it as commission, the gospel being preached on the world, in verse 15, it says, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Mr. Armstrong always stopped at verse 14 and understood that this was the commission, the work given to him and the Philadelphian church to do. The reason he stopped at verse 14 is because that is what God had called him and revealed to him to do. How many times do you hear him talk, read those scriptures, the very ones we read, but never go on to verse 15? He stopped at verse 14. And listened to many sermons and read many things that had been written there and stopped at verse 14 over and over and over again. After that commission had been accomplished, then verse 15 was to unfold, which had nothing to do with Mr. Armstrong nor the Philadelphian church. The abomination of desolation was to occur at the end. After the gospel had been preached to all the world as a witness. Too many today do not believe that Mr. Armstrong and the Philadelphian church finished the work of God that God gave them to do. Our work today is to endure and hold fast to the foundational truths God gave us during Philadelphia and to be preparing ourselves for the soon coming kingdom of God. That's an amazing thing. The last thing you read about in Philadelphia, that's what it tells you to do because of what was coming, what was going to follow. We need to hold fast. God restored things to us as a church. I am so moved when I go back and read things about Sardis, and God says, tells them as a people, as a church, he said, you are dead. That's what described them. And what you have is dying. What they had as far as the truth was dying out. And he referred to them as being spiritually dead. Those are very strong words for God to say about it, his own people. And then we see something that had to happen after that. Incredible. Things that had to be restored to us as a people to carry us up to the end when Jesus Christ returns, because we understand that they're going to be people who are going to be changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Not just resurrected, those are going to be resurrected first, but there's still going to be those who are in the church that are going to be resurrected, that are going to be a part of the church when Jesus Christ returns. And over again in the Bible it talks about a remnant who's going to be there. God's word is true. And so things had to be restored, and also had to be restored to accomplish other things, for this gospel to go into all the world to fulfill that prophecy. Going on in the last part of this, last paragraph here that I wanted to read. We live in the time of Laodicea. It is the end time when the abomination of desolation will be working upon the church. The physical type of what is spoken of in Daniel is about the abomination that worked to destroy the temple. The spiritual type is about the church, the spiritual temple, and the abomination that would work to destroy it at the end of this age. Those are very sobering things. That's why when we go back and we read some of these things, what has been said, what Paul said back in 2 Thessalonians, that there had to be an apostasy within the church in a very powerful way, and there would be things that would begin to work within the church, within the temple of God, not just talking about the destruction of a physical temple here, but a spiritual temple that was going to work to destroy and to tear down, to make desolate. Could you give a better description of something that we have lived through? Do you know how much of the church yet remains? Do you know how many... I can't help but talk about these things. When I think about back in 1985, when certain things began to be said within the church and the structure from the top down, no apostles, no one in times past, there's never a record of this ever happening within the church of God, that someone came along and tried to move and motivate a church to turn totally away from God, to turn away from the Sabbath and the holy days that identify us as his people, and to say that they're no longer commanded upon God's people. And what has it done? Do you realize within a very short period of time, weeks, that a third of the church quit at that time? Quit. And not too long after that, you could do some statistics and some reading of what was in different... studying in different churches, how many people were in different groups and so forth, scattered out here, and how much was still in worldwide and the like. And by that time, another third had already gone back to that which they had been called out of. Didn't quit, but went back totally away from the Sabbath and holy days, back to what's being observed today even, beginning to hold on to things that they were called out of. Those things are shocking. Those things are sobering. Could you give a more descriptive thing here? The abomination that makes desolate, that destroys the temple of God, that begins to work to destroy within the temple at the end of the age, an apostasy that had to happen within the church when there would be a great falling away, as it's translated there, but means apostasy, because they understood, even physically, carnally understood different scriptures here. It's talking about things to happen at the end. In this gospel, the kingdom shall be preached in all the world, and then shall the end come. We have been living in it. What a horrible thing. I don't know if I mentioned this news watch. I think I did, but I've heard a horrible statistic this year. 6,160 people attended the feast worldwide this year. Where have all the people gone? That's a kind of a barometer, in a sense, if you're moved by it, if you're sobered by it, because it continues to become smaller and smaller and smaller, especially when you understand that communion was given at the feast for many of those people. How many of those have the potential of being shaken free yet, that are still holding on to the Sabbath and the holy days, even in that terrible environment? Because there are some, but a whole lot fewer than a year ago. Those things are important, because you see, the abomination that makes desolate isn't over with yet. It's still going on within the church. We're still being scattered. We're still being divided. Things are continuing on, because we haven't come to the end of that part yet. But we live in the end. We're experiencing the things that were prophesied, that Paul talked about, that was going to happen in time before Jesus Christ returned. And Matthew 24 talks about certain things that had to happen toward the end. The gospel had to be preached on the world first, and then the end would come, he said. Let's notice some other things we're admonished to do here, things that are said here in Matthew 24 that should be very moving to us. I think of verse 42, as you go through those different things. I'm not going to go into it today. Talk about it at different times for some of those who have heard different tapes and so forth, but you realize what follows the abomination of desolation, what we're told to do? You know what part of the message is that follows that? Flee for your lives. We have been fleeing for our spiritual lives for some time, different ones in different places, brother. We really have. We've been scattered all over the world, and there have been people trying to hold fast to what was given to us, hold true to what God gave. I think of what it says back in Revelation, chapter 12, when it talks about that which identifies those that Satan goes to make war with, the remnant, who have the commandments, who keep the commandments of God, and have the testimony, the witness of Jesus Christ. That's a description of everyone who's going to be true to God. That's not a negative statement. It's a very positive statement. It's a very positive description of who God's people are. They keep the commandments of God, and they have the testimony, the witness. You know what that means? The witness. The witness that is true is that Jesus Christ, the life of God, is living in and through them. That the power of God's Spirit is evident in their lives. That they are living this way of life. They don't only have the commandments of God and keep those commandments, but that way of life is alive and real because of the Spirit of God and God's love that is in their minds and in their hearts and in their being that's flowing out to one another within the church. That's a description of His people. It's very powerful. It's very beautiful. And then we come down here to Matthew 24 and verse 42 in admonition, where it says, "Watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord has come." But you know, we've gone through some things where Paul gave some warning, and Jesus Christ gave some warning, and we're certainly closer than we were 65 years ago when we knew those truths, and now about what was going to happen in Europe. But know this, that the good man of the house had known what hour or what watch the thieves, you know, what watch, night watch, you know, what watch, what hour. They use the word watch because of the hours of the night. If they'd known what watch, an admonition for us of what we're supposed to do, the thief would come. He would have watched and not have suffered his house to be broken up. He would have been alert. He would have been vigilant. Okay. He would have been on guard. He would have been ready. That's why these are so meaningful to us. Therefore, be you also ready. What a powerful lesson here. For in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes. And if we could understand, brother, and the announcements have already been made to His people, in essence, He is coming. We are at the end. It's just a matter of time. And that time is quickly running down for God's people. Verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant? You know, something to be learned from this is what it goes on in Matthew 25 and talks about in the parable of the 10 virgins. That it is not enough to be wise in the terminology that's used there, because they were guilty as well. They were not ready. Those five, all 10 virgins were described as slumbering and sleeping. They were all guilty before God of not being ready. There's a lot to be learned in those verses. They were not ready. And it's a sin to fall asleep spiritually. We have no excuse as God's people. It's a sin to begin to slumber and to sleep. We are to be moved and motivated. We do have a responsibility to watch and be alert and to be attentive to those things around us in the spirit, in a world that is a very powerful world, of a spirit world as well. Who then is a faithful and wise servant? We'll be faithful to what God has given to us, not just wise. We have to be ready. Whom his Lord shall make ruler over his household and to give them meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing. In other words, practicing, doing this. That's the way of life. We've always understood this. We're always to be alert. We're always to be ready. We're always to be prepared spiritually before God. It's a way of life to be lived. Think of those verses back in Matthew 25 after the parable of the 10 virgins and what it has to say. After it gets through with all that, in verse 13, tells that parable of the 10 virgins, says, watch therefore, for you know, because they weren't watching. You can't watch when you're asleep. You can't watch when you're drowsy. And they were not watching. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man comes. We don't know. But we're to watch. And of all times in God's church, we know, we should know, that we are in the end. How long? Don't know. We don't know. But we know of all people. We've experienced the apostasy. An apostasy that is ongoing. We're able to look over into Europe and see what's taking place and say, the framework is upon us. How much longer? These things should sober us. That's the whole purpose of this sermon today, talking about increasing our sense of urgency. We need to increase that and grow stronger in that. One last verse here, Mark 13, an admonition that's given here, follows up with all this as well. Powerful verses, powerful lessons. These things aren't pleasant to think about. These things are not pleasant to consider. But we must. It's not pleasant to think about what's going to happen in Europe and eventually going to happen in this world. It's hideous. It's horrible. It's a nightmare. But we do have to consider them. We do have to think about them as we see it getting closer and closer. Because this should sober us. That very fact that we're doing it should sober us to the depth of our being, to cry out to our God, to draw closer to Him, to desire He live more fully within us, to be doing what we're told to in Laodicea, to continue to repent, because there are many things that we've been polluted by, sometimes we don't even know, and things we need to grow in as a matter of fighting against things in this world and in our lives to draw closer to God. And we need God more than ever, and we need one another more than ever in our lives as His people to hold fast, because it's hard to hold fast. We need encouragement to hold fast. That's why it's important to have one another. That's why we need each other more and more. That's why each of us should be more precious in one another's sight. I think of a large group like this. Do you know you're incredibly unique? You're incredibly unique. Because there are many people out there who just are by themselves or have two or three or four all over this world. Incredibly unique. Mark 13, verse 32. But of that day and that hour knows no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. It's true still today. But one thing we do know, we know we're getting much, much closer. We know that end time events are upon us. We know that things are being fulfilled and accomplished in a very powerful way. That's what should move and motivate us to greater soberness than ever before. Take you heed, God says. Those are really strong words when He says something like that, when we're told, take you heed, beware, because that's what we're being told. Take heed to yourself. Watch. This is a different word that's used in most places for watch, because it means to keep awake, don't fall asleep. The other word has to do with being alert, being on guard, that we've been reading about. But this one here literally means to keep awake. Don't fall asleep. Same thing. Spiritually for us. On admonition, don't let what happened back there in Matthew 25 take place, obviously. Take you heed, watch and pray, for you know not when the time is. For the Son of Man is a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work. Every one of us. We're involved in a great work. And commanded the porter to watch. The porter. You know, it's like a guard or a sentry. A keeper of the gate. He's to watch. He's to be alert. He's to be vigilant. It's like the night to be much observed. The lesson there. Be vigilant. Be watchful. Observe. In the way God says to. Watch you therefore, for you know not when the master of the house comes, at even or at midnight, at the cock crowing, or in the morning. And that's so much truer today than it was 20 years ago, or 40 years ago, or 1,000 years ago. Because we know that it's coming very, very soon. It's very close upon us. But we don't know exactly when it is. All the more reason we need to be sobered and watchful. Lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Well, brother, now indeed is the time to be vigilant, time to be sobered by the things that we see going on around us, and to think about those scriptures that we read in the very beginning in Thessalonians, when it said to be watchful and to be sober. Now is the time more than ever to be spiritually observant and watchful before God, to be increasing our sense of urgency.